stories of imagination are never far. They still reside in us, guiding us ever forward. Join us now as we journey forward into the past. And here is your host, J.C. Rede.
Hi, friend, and welcome to another episode of Forward into the Past. I'm J.C. Rede, your host and narrator, and today we're finishing up the 1915 Nick Carter mystery, The Gordon Elopement, or Nick Carter's Three of a Kind. Story papers and dime novels were two popular forms of cheap and mass-produced fiction that emerged in the 19th century in the United States. They catered to a large and diverse audience of mostly young and working-class readers who enjoyed thrilling and sensational stories of adventure, romance, crime, and mystery. But what was the impact of these publications on the literacy rates of the American population? Did they help or hinder the spread of reading skills and habits among the masses? Well, according to some scholars, story papers and dime novels had a positive effect on literacy rates, as they stimulated the demand for reading materials and encouraged people to read more frequently and widely. Story papers were weekly newspapers that featured serialized fiction, or stories issued in chapters over several issues. Dime novels were paper-bound booklets that sold for 10 cents or less, and often reprinted stories from story papers or other sources. Both formats offered a variety of genres and themes, from westerns and detective stories to historical romances and urban dramas. They also used simple and accessible language, which made them appealing and comprehensible to readers of different backgrounds and education levels. Some evidence suggests that story papers and dime novels increased the literacy rates of certain groups, such as immigrants, women, and African Americans. For instance, some story papers, such as the New York Ledger and Saturday Night Magazine, targeted female readers with stories of domestic life, love, and morality. Some dime novels, such as those published by Beadle and Adams, featured stories of black heroes and heroines, such as Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. Some immigrants, especially those from Germany and Scandinavia, also found story papers and dime novels in their native languages, which helped them learn English and assimilate into American culture. However, not everyone was enthusiastic about the influence of story papers and dime novels on literacy rates. Some critics, such as educators, moralists, and literary elites, denounced these publications as trashy, vulgar, and harmful to the minds and morals of the readers. They argued that story papers and dime novels promoted violence, crime, superstition, and immorality, and corrupted the taste and judgment of the public. They also feared that these publications would undermine the quality and value of more respectable and educational literature, such as textbooks, classics, and magazines. Well, in conclusion, story papers and dime novels had a significant impact on literacy rates in the United States during the 19th century. They provided cheap and entertaining reading materials for a large and diverse audience who developed a passion for reading and a curiosity for different genres and topics. They also faced criticism and opposition from some sectors of society who viewed them as a threat to the intellectual and moral development of the nation. The legacy of story papers and dime novels can still be seen today in the popularity of mass-market fiction, such as pulp magazines, comic books, paperback novels, and ebooks. And now, friends, let's jump into the thrilling conclusion of the 1915 Nick Carter mystery, The Gordon Elopement, or Nick Carter's Three of a Kind. Chapter 9. The Acme of Knavery. Nick Carter ignored Mortimer Deland's mocking suavity, the miscreant's manifest air of superiority and contempt. He sat down directly opposite the notorious crook, replying sternly,
"That may be quickly told, Deland, and I'm right here to tell it."
"I am listening."
"You wish to know what I'm after?"
"I am after a rascal who has been playing a very extraordinary game. So extraordinary that he might have won out and accomplished his evil designs, had I not butted into the game to thwart it." "Ah,"
drawled Deland. "That makes it very unfortunate for him,
but doubly unfortunate for you, perhaps."
"That last word is well added."
"Indeed?"
"You will agree with me later."
"I seldom agree with men of your vocation," said Deland, smiling ironically. "Be good enough to explain, Mr. Carter. I do not quite get you. For whom are you seeking?"
"For Pauline Perrault, said to have been murdered by Arthur Gordon," Nick replied curtly.
"Dear me, is that so?"
smiled Deland with eyes narrowing.
"I remember Gordon. It was he who started you on my track several months ago, with very disastrous results. I would not grieve deeply, Carter, if evil did befall Mr. Arthur Gordon."
"I am very well aware of that, Deland," Nick said dryly. "Your assurance of it is extremely unnecessary."
"Pauline Perrault, eh?" queried Deland, unruffled. "Said to have been murdered. She is Gordon's stenographer, I believe. I think I have seen her coming from this business office."
"Murdered, eh? Well, what are the circumstances, Carter?
Have you succeeded in finding her, or what is left of her?"
"Yes," Nick said shortly.
"Dear me, is that so?"
Deland did not, in fact, then suppose it was so, Henley being the only one of the four crooks then informed of what the detective had discovered. "I not only have found all that is left of her, but also all that she left behind her," Nick pointedly added. Deland's eyes took on a sharper gleam and glitter, his thin lips a more sinister and threatening curve. The tinge of color in his cheeks waned perceptibly. His long, slender fingers closed involuntarily until their carefully manicured nails bit into his palms. He laughed, nevertheless, in a cold and mirthless fashion, while he echoed inquiringly,
"All that she left behind her?"
"Exactly," said Nick.
"What do you mean?"
"The garments she left in the home of Mrs. Lord, with whom she has been boarding."
"You have been there?"
Deland's brows knit closer and fell to a settled frown over his steadily dilating eyes. "How else could I have found the garments?" Nick demanded.
"Yes, I have been there. And that's not the only place he's been to, nor all—"
"One moment, Henley," Deland coldly interrupted.
"I will hear you presently. Permit Mr. Carter to have his say."
"What more, Carter? What more?"
"Oh, there is a good deal more, Deland, if I chose to tell you all of my discoveries and deductions," Nick now said more sternly. "Ah, indeed?"
"So much, Deland, that it would reveal in every detail the knavish game that you have been playing," Nick went on forcibly. "But you have overplayed yourself, overestimated the value of your cards."
"My cards?"
"Have you not learned, in all the years that you have lived in vice and crime, that three kings, well played, will invariably beat three knaves?"
"Now see here, Carter!"
"Oh, you wanted me to have my say," Nick went on, sternly interrupting. "The three kings that you have been up against, Deland, are Patsy Garvin, Chick Carter, and myself. Three kings in the detective deck. You, Deland, are, single-handedly, the three knaves. Yourself, the man Dayton, and the supposed murdered girl, Pauline Perrault. Three knaves, Deland, never beat three kings."
You say that I am Pauline Perrault?"
gasped Deland, with his wonderful nerve shaken for the first time. "I not only say so, but I can prove it," cried Nick.
I say, too, that you now have Arthur Gordon confined in this house, and that you and these three rascals stop!"
Deland leaped to his feet.
"I have heard enough from you, Carter.
Keep an eye on him, Foster, with a weapon ready.
If he utters another word or makes an aggressive move, shoot him instantly. This way, Henley, into the hall. I prefer to hear your story."
An expression of devilish ferocity now had settled upon his vicious white face. He strode into the hall, Henley following, and for several minutes the two remained there in a whispered discussion. Nick Carter waited with apparent indifference. "There soon will be something doing, I imagine," he said to himself. "I wonder whether Chick arrived in time to pick up his quarry. That now appears very improbable. Fortunately, however, I have another string to my bow, one that Henley does not even suspect. The odds are considerable, but, well, I have never known him to fail to make good."
There was a still more vicious look on Deland's face when he returned with Henley. It was like that which it had worn when, having caught Patsy Garvin as he now had cornered Nick, he left him to die in the Barker tomb. He came and stood directly in front of Nick, gazing down at him and saying with icy severity,
"Henley has made it perfectly plain to me. There is no occasion for you to say more."
"Very well," Nick returned indifferently.
"You are very clever, Carter, very clever,"
Deland went on.
"I have never in Europe encountered an inspector who compared at all with you. You are so dangerous, Carter, that the world is too small for both of us."
"Why don't you move out?" Nick coolly inquired.
"You have exposed my game indeed, and thwarted part of it,"
Deland went on as if there had been no interruption.
"But I have, at least, the money and bonds stolen from Gordon's vault. They are in yonder suitcase."
"Thanks for the information," Nick put in again. "It will save me from searching for them."
"I also have Gordon here, as you have inferred," continued Deland icily. "And, best of all, I have you."
"I would be foolish to deny it," Nick dryly allowed.
"And here, Carter, before we bolt for parts unknown, is where I shall get even with you and with him, where I will forever wipe you out of my path. Gordon is bound hand and foot in a room on the top floor."
"Thanks again, Deland."
"I will send you both to the devil."
"By what route, pray?"
"In a chariot of fire,"
cried Deland with a sudden outburst of ferocity. "Well, well, that will beat walking," Nick declared, not in the least daunted by the significance of the miscreant's threat. Deland swung around to Foster and Gribham, who had stood listening with stoical indifference to the foregoing colloquy.
"Go and get him, you two,"
he fiercely commanded.
"Bring Gordon down here. We will wipe them out together. We will leave no evidence here to tell the story. We will bind both, lock them in the library closet, and then fire the house."
"That's a stuff,"
Henley said with a growl.
"It will burn like tinder. That will finish him."
"Get Gordon! Get Gordon!"
Deland fairly shrieked.
"Bring him to the library. We can be out of here with our plunder, with the deed done in less than a dozen minutes. Go and get Gordon. Bring Carter after me, Henley. Bring him into the library. I'll do it. I long to do it. It shall be my hand that starts the flames."
In another moment, all of them, Nick Carter included, were striding into the dimly lighted hall. Chapter 10. The Other Strings. Patsy Garvin did not ride far with Danny Maloney after their parting from Nick Carter and Henley. Glancing back over his shoulder, Patsy waited only until they had rounded the curve in the road, when he called quickly,
"Slow down, Danny, and drop me. We're out of sight."
Danny obeyed at once, saying regretfully,
"Gee, I wish I was going with you. I might be needed."
"One is better than two,"
Patsy replied, leaping down to the road.
"There's only half the risk of being seen. I can fill the bill all right, single-handed."
"So long, then. Good luck."
"Same to you."
Danny sped on with the car. Patsy Garvin, however, plunged into the woods, once shaping a course that would bring him inside of the crossroad through which Nick and Henley were to pass. It was to enable Patsy to make this detour that Nick repeatedly stopped on the road, pretending he wanted to find footprints left by the missing couple. Patsy accomplished the move with no great difficulty and entirely unsuspected by Henley, owing to the artful attitude toward him that Nick had assumed. Patsy saw them pass along the road, in fact, saw them on the edge of the pond, and then he followed them at a discreet distance until, from behind one of the outbuildings, he saw Nick held up by Henley and afterward taken into the house.
"Gee, that does settle it," he said to himself. "I must know who is in there and what's going to come off. But it won't do for me to approach the house from this side. Those rats are in the rear room, or a side one, or they could not have reached the back door so quickly after Henley whistled. I'll make a circuit to the front road and have a look."
It took Patsy several minutes to do so, seeking the shelter of a wall over which he could plainly see the front of the dwelling, and he then met with an agreeable surprise. A familiar whistle fell upon his ears, and he turned and discovered Chick under the same wall.
"Gee whiz," he exclaimed when they met. "This is dead lucky for fair."
"It's not all luck, I guess," Chick replied. "Give the chief the credit for it."
"You found your man?"
"I arrived just in time to see him leaving his office."
"Well, he must be out here now, since you're here."
"That's right," Chick nodded. "He went round to the back door of the house about 10 minutes ago. I've been waiting and watching till I could get a line on what's going on in there."
"Gee, I can supply that line all right," chuckled Patsy.
"Cut loose, then," said Chick. Patsy informed him with very few words what had occurred, and the subterfuge Nick had employed.
"It now is up to us, Chick," he added. "The gang we want is in that house, and probably Arthur Gordon, too. We must go in and get them. There's nothing else to it."
"Only one thing," corrected Chick, who again was sizing up the house.
"What's that?"
"The way to get in, Patsy, so as to catch them hands down. It's 100 to 1 that they are on the ground floor, also in one of the rear rooms, as you've said."
"Yeah, that's a safe gamble, Chick, in my opinion."
"And I am equally sure that we could not force any of the lower windows without being heard. We can take a chance and approach the front of the house, and by climbing that trellis at the east end of the veranda, we can reach the veranda roof and 3 of the second floor windows."
"Like breaking sticks," nodded Patsy approvingly. "It's dollars to donuts that we can quietly force one of the windows."
"I think so, too."
"Well, what do you say?"
"I say do it, Patsy, and be quick about it," Chick declared when unable to discover a sign of any person in the front part of the house.
"I'm with you," Patsy muttered. "All right, head straight across the lawn to the east end of the veranda."
They vaulted the wall while he was speaking, then covered the distance at record speed. After waiting and listening for a few moments, they felt sure that they had not been seen. To climb the trellis and reach the veranda roof, then, was child's play, and both then began an inspection of the curtained windows. Chick found one through which he could work his knife blade, thrusting up between the sashes, and, in a very few moments, he had succeeded in throwing the lock. Noiselessly raising the lower section, he then pushed aside the curtain, peered in, finding that the window opened into the hall on the second floor. Listening, he could faintly hear voices from below, but could not distinguish whose nor what was said.
"Come on, Patsy," he whispered with a significant glance at him. "Have a gun ready. I'll lead the way." "You won't be far in advance," muttered Patsy dryly.
Crawling quietly through the window, one after the other, they tiptoed toward the broad, angular stairway leading to the lower hall.
"Keep on, old top,"
whispered Patsy, now with a revolver in each hand.
"The sooner we get them, the better."
"I think so, too."
"They're in one of the side rooms. That was the chief's voice."
"Come on," Chick muttered, starting down the stairs. Patsy followed close at his companion's heels. They had made only the first turn in the stairway when the voice of Mortimer Deland, rising high with that last threatening words he was addressing to Nick Carter, coupled with his fierce commands to his 3 Confederates, fell loud and clear on the 2 detectives' ears. Chick Carter glanced at Patsy and pulled out a 2nd revolver. "Fire the house, Willie," he whispered hurriedly.
There'll be firing of another kind done here if necessary.
You bet,
nodded Patsy with brows knitting.
Shoot to kill if you have to shoot.
Kill goes.
They'll come out this way, Chick said hurriedly as they reached the foot of the stairway and paused for an instant near the front door.
Had we better rush in on them?
We might meet them on the threshold and get into too close quarters, said Chick after an instant's thought. We better get them after they come into the hall.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
All right, slip across into that front parlor and be ready to nail them from that side, Chick directed. I'll cover this part of the hall.
I gotcha,
Patsy nodded.
Give a yell when you're ready.
He darted across the hall with the last and into the dim, luxuriously furnished parlor. Chick crouched back at the rise of the stairs. Both scarce had gained these positions when the four crooks, with Nick in their midst, issued from the dining room and headed toward the front of the hall. Chick waited until they were midway between the several doors that no swift leap into each room should save any one of them. Then he uttered the yell for which Patsy Garvin was waiting.
Now, Patsy, get them!
Nick Carter heard them and then saw both. As quick as a flash, he shouldered both Deland and Henley to the middle of the hall, then leaped quickly back into the dining room, out of range of a chance bullet. Chick saw the idea, and a shriek instantly followed his yell.
Hands up, you fellows. We'll drop the first man who resists.
Every man!
Yelled Patsy with both guns leveled. There were four weapons covering the crooks, with bullets enough in all to have riddled them. Only one of them acted under the impulse of desperation, Jim Henley. His shotgun, with which he had been prodding Nick in the back, leaped to the hollow of his arm.
Bang!
It was Chick's revolver that barked. The shotgun fell to the floor, and Henley with it shot through the head. Nothing more sanguinary and determined was needed. Deland and his other two Confederates instantly threw up their hands, kept them up till Patsy and Nick Carter were ready to fit them with bracelets. That ended the sensational features of the extraordinary case. Henley died within an hour, and 2 hours saw the other three in the tombs, two to be convicted and sentenced a fortnight later, and Mortimer Deland to return to finish his unexpired term in the state's prison. Arthur Gordon was found, as stated, bound hand and foot in an upper room of the old house. Though intensely grateful to the Carters for his rescue and liberation, he was 1,000 times more surprised at what they had told him. Up until that moment, he had not dreamed of the true identity of Pauline Perrault, who had, as Nick had inferred, artfully wheedled him into meeting her on a supposed business matter with a friend that evening, only to throw him into the hands of Henley, Foster, and Brigham. The gratitude of Mr. Rudolph Strickland and the joy and relief of Wilhelmina when Gordon was brought home safely and the truth made known were all that the most vivid imagination could picture. Their reward to Nick and his assistants, too, was in corresponding proportion. It afterward appeared, too, that all of Nick's suspicions and deductions were absolutely correct, and that Deland, in assuming the character of Dayton, had done so only to have a quick refuge from Gordon's office if it became necessary, and a character in which he could bury Pauline Perrault at a moment's notice. Nick Carter had thwarted him completely, however, and had secured him, temporarily at least. The end. Well, friends, that about wraps up this story. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed narrating it. And if you did enjoy it, let me know. Drop me a line on my website at forwardintothepastpodcast.com. In the bottom right-hand corner of the page, there's a button with a microphone which allows you to send me a voice message or a text. I'd love to hear from you. Or even better, you can rate and review the episode on your podcast app or on the website as well. The merchandise store is open on both Etsy and Shopify for you to peruse. All proceeds help to support the show directly. And it's chock full of nice items, all designed by yours truly. There are a few items with the show logo, but most of them are various graphic print items. Okay, friends, I've rambled on long enough. Until next time, Thanks for listening. Keep sharing the stories and be a good human. Bye for now.